From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a legal battle between the Cook County District Attorney's Office and a group of journalism students at Medill Journalism School in Chicago made the news. The issue is the students' investigation of the 1978 murder of a security guard named Donald Lundahl, a crime for which Anthony McKinney has been serving a life sentence for more than 30 years. The journalism students were part of the Innocence Project, a nonprofit that aims to free wrongfully convicted people around the country. With their professor, David Protes, the class conducted a 3-year investigation during which 2 eyewitnesses, whose testimony sent McKinney to prison, recanted. Dennis Pettis was one of those eyewitnesses. He told the students that 30 years ago, the police had abused and intimidated him into lying about witnessing the murder.
What did they tell you to say happened?
That Anthony McKinney was killed.
And you signed a statement at the time that attested to this. And was that true at the time?
No.
So you're saying today that what you wrote or said at that time was not true?
That's correct.
Okay.
The students compiled other documents, including sworn affidavits that attested to McKinney's innocence. They turned their findings over to lawyers in 2006, but recently, the Cook County DA began to focus on the students.
The students' investigative materials had been subpoenaed by the Cook County State's Attorney, as well as their grades, evaluations of their performance, emails, and class syllabus.
The district attorney's office says it needs that information to prove that the students had no incentive to find the prisoners innocent, that it wouldn't mean a higher grade. The Medill Journalism School says that's ridiculous. While the class's work has helped free 11 innocent men in the past decade, including 5 from death row, they've also investigated cases in which they found the convicts guilty. The DA also charges that the students really are investigators, not reporters, and so they don't deserve the protections that journalists can claim. To which Medill Dean John Levine says,
if you really want to make that argument, you're almost 9 decades too late. Medill has had its students doing journalism in major journalism outlets around the world since 1921. It just seems to me disingenuous at the least and shocking at the forefront to suggest that the people producing journalism aren't journalists.
You're claiming protection for the students under the Illinois Shield Law. How do you think the Shield Law protects these students?
The way the Illinois law is written, what the students did and the stories and the putting it on the web and posting it all and summarizing it for the public and making it available to every professional journalism outlet in the country is journalism.
The DA declined to be interviewed on our show. Mm-hmm. They did send us a lengthy document with their objections. They argue that this is the discovery phase of the McKinney case. They need all of the relevant information regarding the evidence, and they say that the school has only turned over what it wants to turn over, that they don't know basic things like how many times each witness was interviewed by the students. They say this is only a tiny portion of the materials generated by 9 teams of students over a 3-year period of investigation, and they say that in the pursuit of fairness and justice, they are owed more.
In the pursuit of fairness and justice, the prosecutors ought to get off their thumbs and go talk to the witnesses and find out for themselves if those statements hold up. Look, I'm the biggest fan on the planet of Medill faculty and students, and I watch their process up close and personal. But I wouldn't want what journalists or journalism students do to be the backbone of a case going into court. What you want is the prosecutors to do that. That's their job. And they've got this smokescreen up, deflecting attention to the students. If that was really a problem, it would have happened one of the 11 cases over the last 10 years where people have been found innocent in jail and exonerated. It never was necessary then, and the process and the system worked painstakingly and well. This is a attempt for a reason I'm not fully sure. I'm sure I don't fully understand.
Well, that is an interesting question. Why now?
The state's attorney said, I want to know if they wanted to get a better grade. The answer? It doesn't matter what the students feel or what the students think, because the students are not producing evidence for court. The students are producing facts, which they turn over to the law school's Center for Wrongful Conviction, who further checks, and they turn them over to the prosecutors. And the prosecutors ought to, frankly, stop going back to people who have no role in the court process and do what they're supposed to do. I mean, they benefit, we all benefit, if the public believes and knows for a fact that they care as much about innocence as they do about guilt.
Why not turn over the information they're asking for?
They're asking for things, first of all, legally, I can't turn over. If you're a parent and you call me up and ask to see your child's grades, federal law has long prohibited me from providing it. If there wasn't a federal law, I still wouldn't do it. The students need to know that they can have the confidence of talking to their professor and getting the help they need on the phone, in emails, by text message. I'm not about to have them suffer the chilling effect of feeling that if they do their class assignment, they could end up being in court for something that has nothing to do with what's going on in the courtroom.
Medill has asked the court to quash the subpoena, and the judge is set to hear oral arguments next week on November 10th. What are the consequences, do you think, if you fail to get that subpoena quashed?
I think the consequences are that anybody who knows someone in jail and comes across evidence, facts that say, gee, she couldn't have done it, would hesitate to turn it over and say, do I really want to open my life to a fishing operation by the prosecution about things that have nothing to do with the facts that I'm turning over? What a terrible thing in a free society.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Levine is dean of the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in Chicago. As we mentioned, we did request an interview with someone from the Cook County District Attorney's Office. They declined. This week, we mark the passing of Pete Shellam, reporter for the Central Pennsylvania paper, The Patriot News. Shellam's investigative work directly led to the freeing of four prisoners serving life sentences for murder, as well as to the conviction of former Pennsylvania Attorney General Ernie Priate for campaign-related mail fraud. Mike Feely was Shellam's editor at the paper, and he joins me now. Mike, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
So, Ernie Priate, who served jail time in large part due to Shellam's investigation, dubbed him a one-man innocence project, and he was quoted as saying he was there when the justice system failed. I guess Ernie didn't harbor any hard feelings.
No, I think when Ernie went to prison, he came out not just a reform man, but a person who was interested in reforming the prison system. And I think while he put him in prison, he admired the work Pete was doing to get innocent people out of prison.
What's it take to be a one-man innocence project?
He would just dig and dig and dig, and he really loved reading 1,000-page court documents. He loved taking phone calls from prisoners and getting letters from prisoners. You know, you get somebody out of prison, you get a couple letters. You get a second person out of prison, you start getting hundreds of letters.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you get the third person out, you're getting, you know, in a year, thousands of letters. And he would read every one.
The American Journalism Review described him as a journalistic throwback, a chain-smoking B-movie reporter who meets sources in bars, immerses himself in his subject. It sounds like we're describing an old man, but he was only 49 when he died.
49, but boy, we ran a photo of him on our paper, and it actually made me laugh. It felt good. It was the rumpled shirt, the reporter's notebook pad sticking out of his back pocket, looking through files at the courthouse. He had those old-style reporter ideals in a modern newsroom.
What's the sort of stuff that he found that other reporters and investigators and defense attorneys missed?
Stephen Crawford spent 28 years in prison. It was his family's garage where the body was found. The piece of evidence was his handprint in blood on the side of a car. Pretty damning piece of evidence. Pete was suspicious. After reading a lot of court records, he was suspicious of the state police examiner who looked at this, got forensics people from around the world to look at this, and in the end, it turns out that the blood was splattered on Stephen Crawford's handprint. Obviously, he would be touching cars, It was his family's garage, and so the blood had splashed on his handprint, which was a huge turnaround.
So wow.
And then in the Barry Lockman case, Barry was a mentally retarded man who was coerced into a confession now. We can say that easily. Pete actually tracked down DNA in Germany that everyone said did not exist. And it was
DNA
that,
in Germany for a Pennsylvania murder?
Yes, a Penn State professor had been studying that DNA for something and had packed it up with him when he moved to a new job in Germany. Pete tracked it down, and it proved Barry Lockman wasn't the man that everybody said was there.
Shellam discovered that a serial killer lived in the same apartment building as an elderly woman who was murdered. This was a lead that was never pursued by prosecutors who tried and convicted another man.
The fascinating part about that story, it's a fellow named David Gladden. He had run out of all his appeals. He was going to be in prison for the rest of his life. Pete told this great story of why were they not looking at the serial killer next door. And it was just on the power of his whole presentation of the story that the DA decided that he was to be let go.
Now, the day that Gladden was sprung from jail,
it was in the middle of a snowstorm. It was February, I believe, and he had nowhere to go. He had no one to help him out. So Pete got in his car and picked David up in the front of the prison and brought him home. He talked to Pete regularly. Pete became a really good friend of his.
As his editor, were you ever worried about Pete getting too involved with his subjects?
Pete is a contradiction. I'm going to read you something from a former colleague, Pete Shelley. He's writing an op-ed piece for us for Sunday, and I got to look at it. He was gruff and abrasive and profane, and he could trade barbs and slurs not fit for a family newspaper with the best of them. Forget the front page or Woodward and Bernstein. Think Columbo without the charm. But here's the rub. Pete cared deeply about justice and fairness. He cared deeply for the down and out, for the men and women who literally had nobody else to turn to.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
Mike Feely was Pete Shellam's editor at the Patriot News. Shellam died this week at the age of 49. The paper is setting up a journalism scholarship fund in his name. Go to penlive.com for details.
Coming up, the new plan. Yeah, another one to save newspapers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We all know about the crumbling news industry, how shrunken ad revenues have led to shrunken reporting. Recently, Columbia University's Journalism School weighed in with a report called The Reconstruction of American Journalism, with a half dozen ideas for how to salvage the Fourth Estate. The advice includes granting news organizations tax-exempt nonprofit status, encouraging philanthropic and foundation support, mandating that public broadcasting stations provide substantial coverage of local news, and urging universities to start their own news organizations. Most of these ideas were met with nods of approval, but one prompted some groans, the suggestion that local news outlets be allowed to apply for grants administered through state councils paid for by money collected by the FCC from telecom users, broadcast licensees, and internet service providers. Some commentators, like Alan Rusbridger, editor of the British newspaper The Guardian, applaud the idea and shrug off the concern that government money would compromise coverage.
In Britain, you have something called the BBC, which is not government-funded, but from a license fee which is approved by government. And I don't think anyone would suggest that the BBC is in any way compromised by that form of funding. Indeed, when people do surveys, the BBC emerges as the most trusted news organization in Britain.
But for the most part, the responses to the idea of government-funded grants met with skepticism, if not downright scolding. Here's Paul Starr, a professor at Princeton University and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine.
The danger is that the awards will go to journalists who don't make trouble. And those that do make trouble, that are in fact often performing the most valuable service for the public by uncovering things that are wrong with government, that they might be excluded.
We asked Leonard Downey, former executive editor of The Washington Post and co-author of the report, for his reaction to the reaction. Len, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you very much.
Permit me, please, to pile on for a moment.
Sure.
Putting aside every other consideration, politically, in the United States, the idea of the government underwriting the Marxist media, isn't that as much of a non-starter as it could possibly be?
First of all, the media is much more diverse than that, as you well know. Probably the fastest growing audience in the country is for conservative media like Fox News. We're talking about local coverage, not national coverage, not the stuff that gets into ideological fights and political fights. And we're talking about doing virtually the same thing that's already being done for museums and symphonies and scientific research and medical research, all of which are public goods that cannot be supported entirely by the marketplace. And I believe every American can tell now the marketplace is no longer supporting news reporting at anywhere near the level it was before. So I don't think they'd find it outrageous to turn to nonprofit funding sources of various kinds, including the government.
Another objection falls in the category of he who pays the piper calls the tune. A number of people have freaked out at the notion of even the taint of conflict of interest when local news reporting is fundamentally subsidized by government. Putting aside political considerations, the journalists themselves don't want to be tarred with that brush.
That depends on whether you're a journalist with work or a journalist without work, as a matter of fact. First of all, advertising has subsidized news all these years. So it was possible all during that time for individual advertisers to try to influence the news. And on some occasions, they did. But by and large, when that was exposed, it stopped. And by and large, it didn't happen because you had so many diverse sources of funding. No one advertiser could hold sway. And we're talking here about government grants as part of an overall diverse funding for these new news organizations. And by the way, nobody's accusing NPR of being corrupted by the government.
Well, just permit me to correct you, but there are many people accusing NPR of being corrupted by the government. Probably not as many who are accusing it of being Radio Moscow, but nonetheless, there is a large constituency who believe that NPR and all of its stations are simply tools for the man.
Sure, there are other people that have that suspicion, just as there are people that are concerned about public money going into the National Endowments for the Arts or the Humanities, or even into the National Science Foundation or NIH. And occasionally there are controversies over that, and there is political opposition. But so far, all those institutions, including NPR, have survived. They're prospering. And I believe that that can happen in this case, too. And not without controversy, but I believe it can work.
A moment ago, you invoked the name Fox News. It is clearly politically inflected in almost everything it does. Equally, I guess MSNBC is politically inflected, but that's not limited to just national news organizations. Some local newspapers and radio stations also are arms of ideology as much as they are of news gathering. I'm thinking of Richard Mellenscaife's Pittsburgh paper and others. And the idea of them getting my tax dollars makes my flesh crawl. And I'm sure an equal number of people, their flesh will crawl at the idea of the liberal media being the beneficiary in any way of their tax dollars.
Again, I think it comes down to the growing realization of Americans that news coverage is in trouble. And very few newspapers are like Richard Mellenscaife's newspapers. Most cover the news straight, even though they have strong views on their editorial pages. And people know that. The American public is smart. And they understand the difference between opinions and news coverage. And they can see for themselves that particularly local news coverage is in trouble. So I think if you offer them the possibility that the government is not going to subsidize that newspaper entirely by any means, in fact, much of these grants will be going to new news organizations competing with the newspapers, creating the kind of competition that actually is usually the enemy of bias, they will think seriously about that. Whether it'll happen immediately or it'll take longer than that, I believe that the deterioration of the newspapers across the country will help convince people that something like this would be a good idea to at least try.
All right. Well, Len, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Leonard Downey, former executive editor of The Washington Post, is co-author of The Reconstruction of American Journalism. News may be taking a hit, but there's no shortage of content on the internet. One of the largest content providers is a company you've probably never heard of. Based in Santa Monica, California, Demand Media churns out thousands of articles and videos every day for its own network of websites and places like YouTube. Like many internet successes, Demand Media has a formula, literally a formula, for generating its brief quasi-news items. Here's how it works. A specialized computer algorithm finds the most popular search terms on the internet, crosses those with a list of keywords paid for by advertisers for adjacency to those searches, and then crosses those with, well, Daniel Roth is a senior writer for Wired magazine, and he wrote about the company recently. He can explain it better with a real example.
The algorithm sees that people are searching for these two words, cake butterfly. For some reason, the keyword rates are pretty high, and there's not a lot of content out there right now that has cake and butterfly in it. It then takes those two words, sends it off to another algorithm, which then looks to see what other longer searches have used the word cake butterfly. They might find something that says cake, decorating, butterfly, free, how to make. A proofreader, this person who gets 8 cents a headline, looks at it and comes up with a headline, how to make cake decorating butterflies. Another proofreader gets another 8 cents.
Take that, computers. Right. Take that.
The humans. The humans come in and save the day.
Only humans can right. create poetry, my friend.
Right. And then another proofreader comes in for another 8 cents and changes it to how to make butterflies for cake decorating. Demand now has its title. It knows that this is something that will make it money. A freelance writer goes to Demand's website, sees that Demand is asking for someone to make an article about how to make butterflies for cake decorating. They write it up as quickly as possible. They get paid $15. A copy editor gets $2.50 to copy edit it, and then it shows up on one of Demand's websites.
Demand Media has a channel on YouTube with how-to stuff where you interview experts. They've had almost 1 billion views for their videos.
Demand is the single largest publisher of content to YouTube. YouTube loves it because they have a lot more advertisers than they have space to put the advertising. Demand gives them a place to put their advertising. And what this company is talking about doing, what the CEO thinks he can do by next year, is produce 1 million pieces of content a month. Right now, they're doing about 4,000 pieces a day.
But the content is produced in such a quick and dirty way. Are people satisfied viewers with the content that they have clicked on?
Well, some of these videos and some of the articles are horrible. They're worthless. Some are pretty good. None of them are great. None are rules to live by. But if you want to know how to get rid of wasps in your pool, this is a pretty good 7-step program to figure out how to do that. Demand just announced that they're going to start offering health insurance to their freelancers. There's a lot of laid-off journalists out there looking for work. You can imagine many of them migrating to Demand as they try to figure out something else to do with their life. I think that the quality of the writers and the producers are going to actually improve for Demand. If they raise their prices, I think they'll improve even more. And you could see these videos and the articles going from horrible and good enough as the scale to okay and maybe a little bit better than good enough. You know, these things could move up. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution used Demand to find for $15 an article about 7 great spots near Atlanta.
Okay, so there are feature stories about traveling the country roads of Georgia, and then there's actual journalism, there's actual political and governmental coverage, and all the stuff that's most important about what we do. Can you imagine a day when this is a conduit for actual news?
Yeah, I could see that happening. Right now, the money's not there. Advertisers aren't willing to pay to be next to breaking news or political news. Keyword advertisers want to be next to things that are going to push people to buy something. If you're traveling Georgia's roads, you might want to know where to get new tires for your car. You might want to know where to stop and get mason jars. I don't know. You don't have that with hard news. On the other hand, Demand says they could see a time in the near future where they're not selling just on keyword. And in fact, you get people who are willing to sponsor or put a banner up next to a certain type of content. You pay a certain amount of money and I'll cover the campaign trail. It's not as incredibly scientific as Demand has it right now, but I'm sure that they are thinking along those lines.
This is all extremely fascinating. It's the highest expression of digital technology. No animals were harmed in its making. Why am I horrified?
Because the machines are ruling us all. Demand used to have editors decide what it was going to have its freelancers write about. When they put in the algorithm, they found that the machine was able to come up with headlines and titles that were worth 5 times more than what people who were trained for years and went to journalism school or just have been in the industry for forever, your gut told you what people should be writing about, what people wanted to see. Turns out our guts are worthless. Algorithms are worth a lot.
Well, Dan, thanks. Thanks for nothing.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Roth is a senior writer for Wired magazine. Last month, 16-year-old Chicago student Darian Albert was beaten to death outside his high school. Even in a city ravaged by violence, it was a big story, but it got a whole lot bigger when videos surfaced of the beating. It shows a scene of chaos, a fight between kids from two different neighborhoods that quickly and senselessly escalated to a point where Albert, a sophomore honor student, was struck and killed with a piece of lumber. The video is horrifying, and even in today's violence-soaked media climate, it's something of a shock that it was actually aired by local TV stations and cable news networks. The first outlet to show the footage was Fox Chicago, which acquired it after one of its reporters met the older brother of a student who recorded the video while picking up his younger sister from school. The station bought it for what it says is its standard fee of $250. Fox Chicago News director Carol Fowler says paying for news footage is fairly routine, but airing this video was anything but.
I got to tell you, as news director, it certainly gave me pause. My first thought was, how can we possibly put this on TV? But one thing I have learned over the years is that one or two managers shouldn't be making a decision this important. You include the whole newsroom to the degree you can in the discussion. And that's literally what we did. Darlene herself, our reporter, actually made a very good point. There's a lot of lip service paid to, well, these kids have to walk through unbelievable circumstances to get to and from school. This shows exactly what it is like. We had a journalistic obligation to air it. How could you not? We just had to.
Now, there's a couple of other wrinkles in the acquisition of this video. One is that the guy who shot this thing was kind of mercenary about it. He at least told you that he had gone to other stations and refused to do business.
One other station, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But refused to do business with them because they wanted to pay him by check instead of $250 hard cash.
Right.
And also the fact that during the course of the 2 minutes in which this young man mm-hmm. was beaten to death, no apparent attempt to dial 911, to notify the police,
right.
to do anything to intervene.
That bothered me, too, until I talked to the reporter. There was a man who shot the video. He's an older brother. The explanation I received was that, look, I have a sister in this school. All I hear about is that it's chaos. There are factions of kids fighting with each other inside and outside of school. We drive upon this fight going on, and I want to videotape it. And it was important to him to show people the reality of what's going on. To the degree to which he was satisfied that other people were calling the police or other people were calling 911, Bob, I can't be certain of that. You can argue, certainly, did he do the right thing? And I would argue that he did, because we have the video. It's a tragic situation, but it certainly opened a lot of eyes to the conditions that these kids are faced with daily.
For the residents of those neighborhoods, I can see two potential reactions. One is thank you for shedding some light on the conditions mm-hmm. in which our teenagers have to just risk their lives to walk to and from school. Mm-hmm. And another is, how dare you be so reductionist as to portray us as barbarians and monsters? Don't you realize that things are so much more complicated? I know you got some of the former. Did you get any of the latter?
No. No. Every voice was, thank you, thank you, thank you. We're living in hell. You know, as I look back on all of this, I just think about, how would this child, Darian Albert's death, been reported and viewed had there not been a photographer with a camera. He would just be another statistic. And only after this incident, you know, largely people watching the video, I think, has really the school system, the politicians in the city, even the White House is taking notice of what is going on.
So you knew what happened. You knew you had video. You look at it. What is your reaction?
The video that I watched and was watched by many internally was the raw video. News people are about as cynical and hard-edged as they come. There were people in our newsroom who said, I can't watch this. I have to turn my head. You like to feel like inside every person is a respect for humanity. And to see other young people, once he, you know, was knocked to the ground, then kick and spit on him, it was sobering in a way that I can't even describe. Just sadness. That was my overwhelming feeling.
Well, Carol, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure.
Carol Fowler is news director at Fox Chicago.
Coming up, why science scares us and why dead authors apparently don't.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day. At wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Scientific breakthroughs always engender some suspicion and fear. In the 18th century, Benjamin Franklin chose not to inoculate his 4-year-old son against smallpox. After the boy died from the virus, Franklin urged parents not to make the same mistake, writing in his autobiography that even though the immunization had its risks, quote, the regret may be the same either way, and that therefore the safer should be chosen. Science often forces us to weigh risk against benefit, but fear can throw everything off balance and cloud our judgment. New Yorker staff writer Michael Spector writes about this problem in his new book, Denialism: How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives. With a title like that, in chapters including Vaccines and the Great Denial and The Organic Fetish, Spector makes it clear where he stands. Here's what he writes about the fear of genetically modified food.
We expect miracles, but have little faith in those capable of producing them. Famine remains a serious blight on humanity, yet the leaders of more than one African nation, urged on by rich Europeans who have never missed a meal, have decided it would be better to let their citizens starve than to import genetically modified grains that could feed them.
Given the stakes, Spector says that the fear of new food technology is unreasonable.
The number of people who have been shown to have been made sick by eating genetically modified food is exactly zero. No people ever. This is a technology that isn't just to make farmers rich with special pesticides, but it's a technology that, if used correctly, those are very important words, never said, can help more crops grow, use less insecticide on the land, and use less water to grow the crops, and give us more diversity. In Africa, cassava is a very common foodstuff for hundreds of millions of people. It's just a bunch of carbohydrates. It doesn't have any real nutrients. It has no protein. So a bunch of people funded by the Gates Foundation are now trying to genetically engineer it to have those things, to have fewer carbohydrates, to have vitamin A so you don't go blind. To be able to eat the thing that's in front of you and have it help you is a scientific achievement. It's not something to be afraid of.
Isn't this the same as it ever was? I mean, haven't we always been afraid of science, and haven't we always been in search of easy answers?
What concerns me is that many, many more people feel this way than ever before. The organic food movement has become something of a religion. I eat organic food, but only because it tastes better. We have a billion people in this world who go to bed starving every night. We can't solve their problems with organic food. So these are big issues, and they're bigger than the sort of small group of Luddites who used to, you know, beat up on printing presses in the past.
Many people think that it's just wrong for a journalist ever to take sides with the likes of big agribusiness or big pharma. I wonder, have you ever been accused of being a shill?
Not more than daily. It's amusing. I did a chat for The New Yorker on the flu a week ago, and some guy came on the line and said, is it true you take money from pharmaceutical companies? And I was happy to get the question because the answer is I never have and I never will, not a penny. They have, like all corporations, aspects that are really repulsive. They also do some great things, and we ought to take the good and not just throw it away. But anyone who ever writes anything that suggests that agricultural biotechnological firms or pharmaceutical companies aren't wholly evil and that their entire goal isn't to destroy humanity are shills.
Another big chapter in your book, Vaccines and the Great Denial. This probably is one of the things that upsets you most.
Yeah, I am a parent, and it upsets me most because it's almost like beating yourself on the head to talk to people who believe that vaccines cause, in particular, autism, which is the biggest concern for many people. People tend to get shots about the same time that the symptoms of autism develop between the first and second year of life. If you have a kid who seems to be developing normally, he gets a bunch of vaccines and suddenly he doesn't develop normally anymore, it's completely normal and reasonable to wonder if those two things are related. And many, many studies have been devoted to that question, and never has there been one that's shown a correlation. There have been studies involving millions of children that show that those who are vaccinated and those who are not vaccinated develop autism at the same rate, and sometimes those who are not vaccinated develop it at a slightly, though statistically unimportant, higher rate. It doesn't matter. You can't convince people. And we have a situation where autism is a very serious problem in our country. And we're not spending the money we should be spending on that because we're spending so much time debating whether or not to use the most effective public health measure that there has ever been in this country.
Let's talk about the media here, because that's what this is about. It's about public perception. And you say part of the problem has to do with the internet.
Well, the internet is a wonderful thing, but anyone can whip up a website and look pretty official and say whatever the hell they want. So if a study says this year's flu shot will take away from the effect of the swine flu shot, that was a small study done in Canada. It hasn't been peer-reviewed yet. We don't know how many people were in it. Several other studies in America have tried to reproduce it and failed. But nonetheless, it's whipped around the world instantly in headlines everywhere because the internet is its friend.
Well, so what are we who have no science background supposed to do?
Well, I don't think you have to be intensely scientifically literate to look at a newspaper article or a study and ask a few questions. Who's being quoted? How many people were in the study? Was it peer-reviewed? And peer-review isn't magic, and it's criticized a lot. But if a bunch of outside scientists study something independently, it does give some credence to a study. If no one studies it independently, it's a bit of a problem. These are things that are usually apparent just in the newspaper articles that are screaming about these issues. Then they can go to their beloved internet and look at the other studies and say, gee, well, this one has 11,000 people, this one has 112. This one lasted 4 years, this one lasted a week and a half. Those are things everyone can notice.
There are a number of people who monitor science journalism who say that science on TV news is pretty much a lost cause.
Well, I hate to say anything is a lost cause, but it is true that if it bleeds, it leads. They love the H1N1 flu stories. They love them. First, they love the story about how people are trying to get herded into being vaccinated. Now, they're flipping out because there's a, quote, shortage of the vaccine. This is a two-week span, and you're seeing extreme examples of both kinds of reporting by the same people.
In the last chapter of your book, you discuss the possibilities of future bioengineering. And you quote the scientist Drew Endy as saying, science has often proceeded by skipping the dialogue. What kind of dialogue should we be having right now?
These issues are very severe. We have global warming problems. We have health problems. And many, not all by any means, solutions can be found in agricultural biotechnology and the use of synthetic biology, which is creating types of organisms to treat diseases, to digest carbon. This isn't science fiction, but it is also scary. I mean, you start making creatures that don't exist, and people flip out, and they have every right to flip out. And I think if we had a conversation, a very high-level, serious conversation now about the risks and the benefits, it would help. We never had that conversation with genetically modified food. So people scream about it, and they scream from a lack of sophistication and knowledge. And I think if there had ever been a dialogue, that would have helped. I hate to see that happen now. I hate to see the future development of synthetic solutions to our problems be impeded by people who are afraid of them without understanding that there are also amazing theoretical benefits.
Michael, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Brooke.
Michael Spector is the author of Denialism: How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives. Slate columnist Ron Rosenbaum once wrote of author Vladimir Nabokov, quote, "Encrypted within his words, encoded indecipherably, ambiguously, is something akin to the secret code of higher human consciousness, the DNA, the genome of genius." Rosenbaum's a fan. Nabokov, of course, is the author of beloved works like Pale Fire and Lolita, which he wrote both in Russian and English. Here he reads from that.
Perhaps not everybody remembers the way Lolita starts in English. Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul, Lolita, the tip of the tongue.
When Nabokov died in 1977, he left behind an unfinished novel and explicit instructions that upon his death it should be burned. Instead, it was locked away. Eventually, the decision about what to do with it fell to his son, Dmitri, who simply didn't decide. That is, until Ron Rosenbaum came along. In his Slate column, he made the case for resolving the fate of Nabokov's manuscript once and for all, either publish or destroy. This final work of a genius should not languish in purgatory. And on November 17th, Nabokov's final work, The Original of Laura, will in fact be published, complete with a thank you from Dmitri to Ron Rosenbaum for his unanticipated publicity campaign. But despite Rosenbaum's central role in liberating his cherished writer's last work, in direct contradiction of his cherished writer's wishes, Rosenbaum says he's still not sure it was the right decision. Because when it comes to a great author's last unfinished work, it's too easy to rationalize defying a dying wish that denies us our pleasure.
So many people said, oh, he didn't really mean it, or, you know, he's so great, therefore we don't have to respect his wishes, or they'd bring up Kafka.
Which we're going to bring up right now. You think Franz Kafka, creator of absolutely immortal works like Metamorphosis, ought to be regarded as a special case when he basically asked for all of these immortal works to be burned. Tell me why you think Kafka's a special case.
Well, I'm not sure it is. You know, I mean, I think it may well have been a violation. And if there's an afterlife, perhaps he's gnashing his teeth. But on the other hand, with Kafka, we had maybe 10% of his work available. We would have lost the trial and the castle. There wouldn't have been a Kafka. Maybe that's what makes it special, even though I still think the first principle should be respect the wishes of the creator.
Well, let's take a case that's a bit more complicated. David Foster Wallace, the author of Infinite Jest, who committed suicide last year. He didn't leave any instructions about what to do with his unfinished work. His agent is now sorting through various drafts of things. Foster Wallace apparently agonized over every word. And to some people, the idea of publishing unfinished work actually dishonors his memory.
He did not, however, say, don't publish it. With that in mind, the question is, should all these loose papers be relegated to some university library in the form that they were found? Or should someone be brought in to cobble together some, quote, finished, unquote, version of what's left behind? I believe that if you're going to publish something, it should be in as raw a state as possible. Don't try to impose an order on it that may not have existed even in the author's mind.
Because the order you impose may not be the one that's imposed for all time. Look what happened to Hemingway's novel, The Movable Feast. One wife put it together in a particular way. Later, a grandson comes along and says that's not what he intended.
I'm in favor of let 100 flowers bloom. So let there be 4 or 5 editions of A Movable Feast. Raymond Carver's widow, isn't she now planning to issue the unedited Raymond Carver?
And that's a fascinating issue because Raymond Carver's known for such austere prose. And it turned out he was way more wordy and that perhaps his editor helped create the Raymond Carver that we admire.
I know, it raises questions of what we mean when we say Raymond Carver, which is a very difficult question. But I'm in favor of publishing more and letting people judge for themselves what they think the author intended if he did not leave clear indications himself.
So, Ron, I think anybody listening to this would think that you would have been firmly opposed to bringing out Vladimir Nabokov's last unfinished work in direct contravention of his own instruction. And yet, it turns out you are responsible. How did you get into this?
Well, I first learned about the existence of these 138 index cards in a Swiss safety deposit box some years ago. I started writing about it in 2005, and it seemed to me that this should be a matter of more concern. It was left in the hands of his son, Dmitri, to burn on the instructions of his father, and yet he hadn't burned them, and occasionally he would issue remarks that made it seem like this was a real treasure, a new way of looking at his father's work or his final achievement. So I was always conflicted, but I was in favor of making a decision. You know, at first I thought, wow, this is so exciting. I want to see it. And then in my last Slate article, I said, you know, I'm still conflicted, but I believe that it should be burned. An author's wishes stated that clearly deserve to be respected.
And so it's decided. The original of Laura will be published. You've had the privilege of seeing it in advance. It originally existed in index cards. What's it look like now?
Every page was a very thick paper, and in the top center of the page was precisely one of those index cards scanned and reproduced exactly as Nabokov had with his pencil-written sentences and blottings out and scrawlings out, all there, the cards exactly as they were. And this is the daring and probably controversial thing, is the cards were perforated so you could punch them out and hold them in your hands the way Nabokov did. But I think it captures the provisional nature of it. You know, these were index cards. This was not a finished book.
Does he have good handwriting?
You know what he has is like good crossing out. He has managed to devise a way of scrawling out his words that he decides to leave out in a way that you can't decipher what's underneath the slinky-like scrawls, no matter how hard you stare, although I think I deciphered 2 words that Knopf or Dmitri might have missed in their transcript.
Well, do you think that the vehement way he crossed things out might be an indication that he didn't want anybody to know his process?
I think there's some truth to that, but it sort of brings us closer to him to see how important it was to him that he not leave any imperfect tracks behind.
Did seeing his process diminish Nabokov's genius for you, or the reverse?
I think the reverse, actually. I think it indicated that he was very human in a way, which is what gives his novel not the cold perfection that some see in it, but in fact the very human insight into the soul.
This novel or any novel?
All the ones I've read.
So after this debate, what's your verdict? Was it a good decision to publish or not?
Wow, I'm still conflicted about it. I mean, I think I hold to my position that probably we should have respected Nabokov's wishes. But look, it's done. It's there. And so I couldn't resist looking at it.
And you're glad you read it?
I'm glad I read it.
Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Ron Rosenbaum is a columnist for Slate and author, most recently, of The Shakespeare Wars.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Harver and Dan Mazzi, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.